Welcome to Drinks Insider, the podcast that's interested in everything you can drink. If it's legal, if you can sell it, and more importantly, if you can make money from it, then we're going to talk about it. So come on this journey into the commercial world of everything drinkable. I'm your host, Felicity Carter, and you're listening to Drinks Insider. Alcohol comes with a huge cost. It gets us drunk and hungover and full of remorse. It makes us violent, it puts us in accidents, and it gets some of us pregnant accidentally. Drink enough of it over a long enough period of time, and alcohol will shrink your brain, give you cancer, or wreck your liver. So why do we touch the stuff when it has all of these downsides? Well, as Edward Slingerland explains, it's because we wouldn't have civilization without it. Edward Slingerland, a professor of philosophy at the University of British Columbia in Canada, has written a book called Drunk: How We Sipped, Stumbled, and Danced Our Way to Civilization, which has been called a, quote, deep dive into the alcohol-soaked roots of civilization. It's a wildly entertaining book that demonstrates that a lot of what we think about alcohol is flat wrong. That idea that we used it to make dirty water safe for drinking, for example, wrong. Anyway, as soon as I read the book, I wanted to get Professor Slingerland on the podcast to talk about why we drink and what we might lose if we abandon it. I'd be interested to hear your take on the episode. I'm going to write it up for my newsletter at drinksinsider.com. And if you have any thoughts, drop me a line at felicity@drinksinsider.com. So thank you so much for joining me today. I really enjoyed your book, Drunk, which is what I want to talk to you about.
I can't wait to talk about it.
Okay, so I read that you originally studied Chinese philosophy. How did you go from Chinese philosophy to doing a history of alcohol?
Yeah, a lot of my colleagues want to know that as well. It's a bit of a surprise. There's actually a direct connection between my earlier work and Drunk. So one of the connections is I'm interested in spontaneity.
Okay.
So my earliest work looked at these concepts of spontaneity in early China.
How spontaneous were they?
Their goal was to get into a state of what they called wu wei, which I translate as effortless action. But it's a state where you lose a sense of yourself as an agent. You kind of lose a sense of the passage of time, but everything works out. You're very successful in what you're doing. People like you. You have charisma. So they all wanted to get into this state. But they all face the paradox that I call the trying not to try paradox, which is how can you try to be spontaneous? It seems like trying to be spontaneous defeats the purpose. And they came up with various kind of behavioral workarounds to try to get around the problem. But when I wrote a general audience book about this topic called Try Not to Try. And in presenting on it, I actually started to think about, you know, one way to think about alcohol is as a cultural technology that helps you get around this tension. You know that you're going to be at your best if you're relaxed and kind of off the cuff and being funny. But if you try too hard to do that, you won't be funny. but if you maybe have a glass of wine or two, the chemical substance in there, ethanol, the active ingredient, can actually go in and downregulate the conscious part of your mind for you. So it's paradoxical to consciously try not to try, but maybe there are other ways to get past that tension.
Did the Chinese use alcohol for this purpose, or did they did? Did it work?
They absolutely did. I assume it did. Yeah, they used it. They continued using it, so you would think so.
All right, so let's go back a step, because of the many, many interesting things in your book, you overturn some of what I understand about alcohol, and I've been writing about alcohol for 20 years. So there's all these theories about why we drink alcohol, from the unlocking of calories from overripe fruit to keeping water safe and so on, and you say that none of that's true. Can you explain why not?
So those are all the standard theory about why we drink alcohol. The standard theories are all variations of evolutionary mistakes.
Yeah.
And so actually the most common one, which you didn't mention, is just the straight hijack theory. So alcohol's never had any function It just ethanol just happens to be a key that turns a lock in our brain. It happens to trigger a reward network for no reason at all. And we've just figured that out. So that's the standard story. If you pick up a Psych 101 textbook, that's the most likely thing you're going to read.
I think that's what you call the evolutionary mismatch, wasn't it?
That's the hijack. That's where the alcohol is just hijacking for no reason at all a reward network. The mismatch are the ones you just mentioned. Because with the dirty water hypothesis or the drunken monkey is the fruit unlocking these calorie packages in the jungle. These are mismatch theories because in those theories, the taste for alcohol actually did have a function in our evolutionary past. So the fact that we get pleasure from alcohol is not accidental. There was an evolutionary purpose for it, but the purpose is gone now. So now that we have safe drinking water, now that we have lots of calories we can get anytime we want, there's a mismatch between this desire. So I compare it to, it's very similar to the story, which this one is probably right, about our taste for junk food. So our taste for fat and sugar was adaptive in the evolutionary past. But now that we live in a society where we have, at least for most of us, we have too much of these substances, it becomes harmful. So that's the mismatch theory.
And it's like bears, like getting drunk as well. It's interesting. Okay, so why is it wrong to say that people used alcohol for, you know, sterilizing water or for those other reasons? How do we know that's not right?
Those could be part of the story, but they can't be driving it. So for the dirty water hypothesis, for instance, if you have dirty drinking water, boil it. Boiling it is a lot faster and simpler and less resource intensive than, you know, making a complicated beer out of it. So people have discovered boiling in various ways, and that drinking boiled water is safe. Not consciously, they don't know the reason behind it. So there, if dirty water is the problem, there are other easier ways to solve that problem. So any of these kind of mismatched stories run up against the problem that, so the calorie thing, you can ferment things into alcoholic beverages, which contain alcohol, which is a harmful substance. It messes with our heads. It is carcinogenic. It can lead to liver damage. You could have the same effect by turning things into porridges.
Mm.
So I talk about we don't know of any major civilizations that, you know, put at the center of their ceremonies eating porridge together. but it, you know, it would have the same effect. You'd be preserving these calories.
Maybe they did, but they died out.
They got outcompeted by the ones who used alcohol.
That's right.
Yeah, very, very true. So there may have been, but we don't know about them anymore. So, yeah, the basic problem is that the cost of alcohol to be borne by us, there have to be actual benefits that are outweighing those costs.
Do you want to run through? Well, actually, let's talk about the benefits in a second, because I want to talk about some of these other myths that you overturn. And one of the really big ones is the bread before beer hypothesis, which says that the idea is that civilization owes its underpinnings to bread, that we learned agriculture and somehow somebody left out some barley and it fermented and we got beer. And in your book, you suggest it's the other way around, that we started with beer. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, so this is part of this revolution in archaeology that started in the 1950s or so, when archaeologists noticed that, so to take the Fertile Crescent, hunter-gatherers were getting together and building this monumental architecture. So at sites like Göbekli Tepe in modern-day Turkey, and having these blowout feasts, they were feasting on gazelles, they were doing some kind of religious ceremony. You know, they erected these huge stelae with these weird animals carved on them. We know nothing about their beliefs. We know very little about what they were doing. But they were feasting and they were drinking huge quantities of liquid because at Göbekli Tepe.
So we do know they were getting drunk.
They were getting drunk. So we don't have direct evidence of alcohol at Göbekli Tepe, but we do have direct evidence from other sites in the region at the same time. So it looks like the first time hunter-gatherers, humans, started to congregate at fixed sites and invest some energy in kind of eating and drinking there, it was centered on alcohol. They didn't have bread yet. This was thousands of years before agriculture in the region. And then this is kind of what you look, when you look around the world, you see a very similar pattern where the first domesticated crops seem to be chosen for their psychoactive properties, not for their nutrition properties. So you see this in South America, you see this in North America. So this is where archaeologists started to say, well, maybe what it is humans wanted to get chemically altered mentally. And that's what motivated them to start settling down and growing crops more intensively. And then by accident, they discovered bread. They discovered that, oh, we can also eat, we can make this stuff into food. It's, in this sense, there's a really direct way. So this is a so-called beer before bread hypothesis. If that's correct, there's a really direct way, literal way, in which our taste for intoxication led to civilization.
So why were people gathering? I mean, you know, it must have been pretty dangerous way back when. Why not just make bread amongst yourselves? Why go and build big pillars and have a big feast?
It's got to have something to do with, this is actually the other connection to my previous work. I've worked on the evolution of religion and cultural evolution of religion. And it seems like religion and I think chemical intoxicants kind of hand in hand helped, or tools that we use to break out of the barriers of small scale cooperation. So all of our primate relatives and humans until relatively recently lived in these small hunter-gatherer bands where you knew it, you were related to most of the people you were interacting with, and if not, you at least knew them by sight. Once we moved to a larger way of like living in large villages or small towns or cities, we have a completely new cooperation problem where we have to figure out how to cooperate with strangers. We have to cooperate with people we've never seen before and will never see again. And it's puzzling from a biological perspective how we pull that trick off. And one of the theories that I've explored in my previous work is that religion's one way we do that. So we get together, we all worship the crocodile god, we all declare our fealty to the crocodile god, we scarify ourselves and we observe taboos and we do dangerous things to show that we really believe in the crocodile god. And that allows us to cooperate. If I see you and you've got a crocodile god tattoo on your forehead, I know you're one of my tribe and this bigger symbolic tribe, and I can count on you. So religious ceremony, what the reason they gathered seems to be that they were forging themselves into larger groups that were bound symbolically in a way that small scale societies weren't. And whenever you see people doing this, they're using alcohol. They're using ritual and music, but also
it's
alcohol.
Interesting. I mean, if you tattoo on your head, you're making a real commitment. I mean, you can't just wipe it off later. But getting drunk with other people, particularly strangers, can be really dangerous. Certainly in the modern world where we have more trust, it's still dangerous. So why alcohol rather than just not tattooing yourself blue?
Yeah, well, both. They often go together. If you've ever been in a college town on a Saturday night, you'll see people getting tattooed at a certain level of inebriation. So they often go together. So what they share in common is they're what cultural evolutionary theorists call costly displays. So it's very easy for me to say that, you know, I'm your friend and I'll stand by you and if anything goes wrong. If I get a tattoo on my forehead, I really am committing to the group. It's very hard to undo that. If I get very drunk with you, I'm going to be hurting in the morning. I'm also making myself vulnerable to you. I'm saying things that I don't have control over anymore. I'm giving up some of my motor coordination.
Some of the earliest human language was the next morning saying, I don't really remember a thing. Did I say that? I don't remember.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. It's a disarming. So I compare getting together and drinking to getting together and first shaking hands. So we shake hands to show that we're not carrying a weapon. We drink together to disarm mentally. So we're essentially taking out our prefrontal cortex and some of our motor coordination at a certain point and putting it on the table and saying, I don't need these things anymore because I trust you and you can trust me. So it's a way to disarm.
So one of the things that you say in your book, which I found fascinating, was the high cost of doing this once, agriculture spread. That I've got written here that beer was so highly valued that rulers had to stipulate that people couldn't use too much of it for beer, that they had to put some aside for food. Can you talk about that?
Well, again, this is part of the bit of evidence against the evolutionary mistake, all the various versions of the evolutionary mistake story. So evolution tolerates mistakes when they're either not very expensive or they're recent because it hasn't had time to deal with it. Evolutionary hijack, I begin the book with the most classic example of the evolutionary hijack, which is masturbation. Right, you're triggering a reward network that in a way that's not what it was meant to do, but it turns out it's relatively costless. Whatever you learned in Catholic school about going blind is not true. It actually doesn't hurt you, and the basic system works pretty well. So it's an ancient behavior, but it's not expensive.
I guess that's why there's the intense prohibition saying you'll go blind is an attempt to put a cost on something.
An attempt to put a cost on it. No, that's absolutely why. In the case of junk food, it actually is costly. It's junk food leads to obesity, diabetes, all these health problems, but it's very recent. Having too many calories is a modern problem. It's not something that we historically have had.
Well, going back to the please put some barley aside. I mean, in a world of crops that couldn't be relied on, this is a very costly mistake to be using it for alcohol. So alcohol must have been very highly prized in early civilization. It must have been prized beyond just getting together once a year and getting drunk together. So once we had become had moved into an agrarian world, what role did alcohol play?
It's playing some nutrition role. So there's probably some truth to some of these byproduct hypotheses. I think the one that seems most plausible is the biological ennoblement idea. So when you take grain and you ferment it, you add micronutrients that aren't present in the grain. And this is one of the theories about why in ancient Egypt, people could live on this, what seems like a very monotonous diet. They basically just ate bread, but they also had beer. And beer was giving them some micronutrients that they needed. It's also giving you calories. There's a lot of calories in alcohol. but mostly what it was doing was performing these kind of daily functions that it still performs for us. Decompression at the end of a workday, so kind of marking the shift from workday to leisure time, reducing stress, enhancing sociality, so making us want to hang out with other people, making us like other people more, making us less likely to lie and better able to detect lies. And it was also enhancing our creativity. So both on an individual level and on a group level, it's enhancing our ability to innovate and create new things. So it's this kind of driver of civilization.
And something else I want to come to in a second, but before then, you also say in your book that people started complaining about the dangers of alcohol at a very early level. When did people first start complaining, and did anybody ever listen?
They started complaining as soon as they were able to complain. So the earliest writings we have are, in China, ancient China, the area I specialize in, some of our earliest written law statutes are prohibition statutes. Anyone
really?
Caught making or consuming alcohol will be put to death. The early Chinese classics are full of stories about how the evil last emperors of a dynasty lost the mandate of heaven because they drank too much. They were always drunk and they were repressing their people. So you see, we're using alcohol from the very beginning, but we're worried about the dangers of alcohol from the very beginning as well.
Is there any other substance that humans have used that we've had this kind of Janus-faced relationship with, or is alcohol unique?
It's really alcohol. I call alcohol the king of intoxicants because it really is just far and away the most widespread substance we're using. It is the case that there are certain parts of the world where, for a variety of reasons, people either didn't discover alcohol or there may have been local ecological reasons why alcohol wasn't safe to consume. And in those places, they do substitute other substances. So in the Pacific, they use kava, which is this mild narcotic. Some places they use cannabis, but we've had cannabis for a long time, and cannabis has decisively lost the cultural evolutionary battle with alcohol. It just is not, there's a variety of reasons why it's not a good drug.
Why? Is it because, I mean, you'd think everyone would get mellow and that would have a social, you know, consequence that would be quite beneficial. So why did cannabis lose out?
It's got a lot of advantages. It's first of all, physiologically, it's a lot less harmful than alcohol. It's not as physically addictive as alcohol is. The two fatal problems, I think, are its effects cognitively vary wildly between people. So some people it makes very mellow and happy. Some people get energized and want to dance or talk about philosophy. Some people, like myself, no matter what strain of cannabis they try, it just makes me paranoid and miserable, and then I fall asleep. So
yeah,
it's
me too.
Very
I loathe it. Every time I've tried it, yeah. I've ended up anxious and upset and grumpy. It doesn't work for me at all.
It doesn't. Yeah, and so that's why it's not a good social drug. If we're all trying to bond, it's no good. If we're all having different reactions to the drug, it's also very difficult to dose. Yeah. So if you're smoking it, you have to know how to hold it in your lungs. If you're taking an edible form, the lag between when you consume it and when it has its effect is notoriously so long that people tend to mess up the dosage and suddenly they've taken too much. Whereas alcohol hits your brain within minutes and is very easy to dose and has very similar effects across individuals. So I think that's why.
Okay. So now I'd like to talk about the creativity phenomenon, which is one of the parts of your book I found the most interesting. Can you talk about the lowering of inhibitions and what this means for creativity?
So children are very creative. Human children are much more creative than human adults. So creativity is an ability that we lose as we age. And in the book, I put a graph of our performance on creativity tasks next to a graph showing the maturation of the prefrontal cortex. So this part of our brain in the front that is in charge of, basically in charge, you can call it the grown-up part of the brain. It's in charge of self-control, planning, delayed gratification, discipline, kind of being able to stop something you don't want to do and do some other thing. So it's the prefrontal cortex, or the PFC, is the key to being a successful adult human. But it also apparently interferes with creativity. You get less creative the stronger your PFC is. The PFC doesn't fully mature in humans until your 20s. It's really weird. You know, you become sexually completely mature much earlier, and yet this part of your brain is still not mature. And I think it's because evolution had a trade-off. It wants us to be creative and flexible like kids, but not for too long, because at some point we need to be able to tie our shoes and get to work on time and pay our taxes.
And look after the kids we've produced.
Look after the kids, right?
when we had no restraint.
Get them to put their shoes on and tie them. So what would be great for humans, adults, is to have all the knowledge and ability and discipline that we have as adults, but be able to temporarily turn the PFC off to regain access to that kind of childlike flexibility and creativity that we've lost. And I argue, so there's a couple ways you could do it. You could zap your PFC with a transcranial magnet. So there's good data that if you do that, you become more creative. You can lesion your brain. You can, you know, go in and take part of the PFC out. And again, we have evidence that when this happens to people through an accident or through a stroke, they become more creative. But alcohol is actually an ancient and very gentle technology for accomplishing the same thing. So you, as one of the main effects of ethanol is to act as a depressant on the PFC to turn down its functioning. And so as you drink, you're kind of making your PFC go back in time developmentally, if you want to think of it that way. And you regain that kind of ability to think flexibly and combine ideas across domains that children have. So it gives you that back.
How does that go with the fact that, you know, there's many of us that have come up with great ideas and the next morning have looked at it and went, that was a pile of shit? I mean, how do you know? What's the difference between, is it just you just keep generating ideas and eventually one of them will be good? All right.
Yes, absolutely. So it's very much like genetic evolution. So genetic evolution works on mutations. You just generate lots of mutations. 99% of them are terrible and get eliminated. But every once in a while, there's one that's good and that becomes fixated in the gene pool. It's Michael Pollan has argued that psychedelics are like a mutagen for cultural evolution. So you create all this wild variation, most of it's nonsense, but every once in a while, something new and cool will work. And that's how you get a new idea. And what I argue in the book is that psychedelics are doing that. Psychedelics are that on steroids, which means that you could come up with something very creative, but the vast majority of what you come up with is complete nonsense. And so I talk about insights that I had on psychedelics that the next day turned out not to be the key to me getting tenure. alcohol is one way to think of it is it's a mild mutagen. So it's making, it's doing that same thing, allowing crosstalk in our brain, but to a lower degree. The amount of entropy it's introducing is lower, which means there's a higher likelihood that what you're coming up with is actually going to be useful.
Yeah. Now, when I first read that, my instinctive reaction, because I've had so many discussions under the influence of alcohol and they were all bullshit, my first idea was, have you got any evidence? But you do. You looked at the level of patents under prohibition. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. So there's very little direct evidence about alcohol and creativity because it's very hard to get human subject approval to use alcohol. So most researchers don't even want to go near it. So there is one interesting correlational study, which was this economist came up with a very clever proxy for group innovation, essentially, which was the number of patents being submitted in a given county. So he had county level data on patent applications. He also had patent level data on when prohibition was imposed. And this is something that I didn't. I had always thought of prohibition as something that happened all at once at the federal level in the states. But it turns out that it was actually imposed at the county level over a long period of time, over a century, really. So he's got essentially a natural experiment. He knows he has a measure of creativity, and then he can see how that measure changes when prohibition gets introduced. And what he found is when a county goes dry, its patent applications go dry as well. They fall by as much as a third, and it takes them years to recover again.
That is so extraordinary.
Yeah. It's correlational, but suggestive.
Of course, but I'm just thinking, so I'm Australian. I come from a very heavy drinking culture.
Yeah.
But for a very small country, the number of patents is actually very, very high. Maybe there's
Maybe there's something to that.
Yeah, I'm saying this hopefully, probably not. But that actually makes me think about some cultures which are very, very creative, which are also very heavy drinking cultures, Britain. Mm-hmm. Okay. So, but you've also mentioned that I think some of the tech companies have used this for their own purposes and that there's an ideal blood alcohol level. Can you talk about that?
So I presented when I was giving talks on my Try Not to Try book, a study had come out, the only study to date on directly on alcohol and creativity, where they got subjects to about 0.08 blood alcohol content. So this is about two drinks in, and found that at that level of inebriation, they were maximally creative. and they were more creative than control subjects who were given a placebo drink that didn't have alcohol in it. So that's the only direct measure of alcohol and creativity. And I finished this, I gave this talk at a Google campus in California, and in the Q&A, somebody's hand shot up and they were like, do you know about the Balmer Peak? And I was like, no, I never heard of that. But supposedly, I don't know, it's probably apocryphal, but supposedly Steve Ballmer, the former CEO of Microsoft, who was a legendarily good coder, discovered that there was this very narrow blood alcohol content where he was superhumanly good at coding and would get himself hooked up to an IV drip of alcohol to kind of keep himself at exactly that blood alcohol content. And he'd code that way all night. So I don't know.
Do you know how, true. I mean, that raises lots of questions about how he discovered that. Was he getting his blood constantly tested?
Correlating
it against his output.
There's a lot of reasons to be dubious about that story. But the basic idea does seem to be correct, that there's a sweet spot of inebriation where you're not so drunk that everything you're saying is nonsense, but you're loosened up a bit. And then, so the interesting thing too is that, so this was at Google. So they told me about the Balmer Peak, and then they took me on a campus tour and they said, oh, we know where we're taking you first. And the first place they took me was their whiskey room. So they have a room where when they run into a problem that is not solvable through kind of brute force, you know, working ABC algorithmic thinking, they go to the whiskey room and they pour themselves some single malt. They had a beautiful collection of single malt scotches and sit in beanbag chairs and get some whiteboards out and talk about it. And they told me that there's a sweet spot, you know, kind of one scotch, suddenly they're coming up with ideas that they couldn't come up with on coffee. So successful companies are using this.
It's definitely the alcohol, not the conviviality and the permission. You know, as soon as you open alcohol, you're sort of giving permission for people to start loosening up just by the act of doing that before you've even consumed alcohol. So it's definitely the alcohol, not the other cues around it.
Yeah. Yeah. That's where these studies that use placebos, these forearm studies are really useful, because you can create drinks that taste and look and smell alcoholic but aren't. So you can control for that, basically the placebo effect. But the placebo effect is not zero. So, and this is why, you know, if you go to I've seen this is a new phenomenon, but these sober bars, right, where they serve non-alcoholic cocktails, but everything else is the same. It's dimly lit, there's music, they look like cocktails. You will get some of the benefits of alcohol from that, because the placebo effect is real. You're definitely, some of it is the cues.
Last year I spoke to Bill Schufelt, who was the CEO of Athletic Brewing, and he said he thought part of the placebo effect was stronger in cultures that had a beer culture, because they were reacting to the smell much more than beer naive cultures would. But definitely anyone who's drunk non-alcoholic alcohol can see that people start behaving as though they've had alcohol. But the experiments you're talking about actually showed something different. Do you want to talk about that? About the way people didn't interact, you know?
Yeah, so these studies, again, with the four conditions. So you have people who are told they're getting alcohol, but they're not. They're being told they're getting alcohol and they are. Or the opposite. So they're told they're not getting alcohol and they are. So you have four conditions, and some of them are involving placebos. What they find is that in the alcohol condition, so you're told you're getting alcohol and you are getting alcohol, you get the strongest effect. And effects like people report liking each other more. People report being bonded, feeling more bonded to the people they were talking with. They come out of it having reported a much more positive experience with the other people involved. But you do get a kind of attenuated effect with the placebo condition, where they're told they're getting alcohol and they're not. So there is a slight placebo effect. I think, and I've seen this placebo effect with, so my wife, for instance, every once in a while just wants to stop drinking just for weight control, health reasons. And she actually drinks Athletic. She really likes those Athletic non-alcoholic beers. And she uses them exactly the way we would normally use pouring ourselves a glass of wine at the end of the workday. She cracks one of those open and pours it for herself. And the mouthfeel and just the sound of opening the can, I think, give you the cues that say, hey, the workday is over and we're moving into a different stage. That is useful. But I also think you could only get that placebo effect if you've been exposed to the real pharmacological agent. So I think if you did that for long enough, it would stop being useful.
Now, for most of human history, we had very weak beer or we had very weak wine, unless you were from the deep south of Algeria or somewhere. And all of that changed about the 16th and 17th century when we got distillation. How did that change our relationship with alcohol?
It made alcohol much, much more dangerous. So I talk about the two dangers of modernity when it comes to alcohol. And the first of these is distillation. So, you know, alcohol has always come with essentially a built-in safety feature, which is the limits of natural fermentation. You can only, an alcoholic beverage that's naturally fermented can only get so strong before the yeast shut themselves down. And we've been ruthlessly breeding yeast for tens of thousands of years to get stronger and stronger. So, you know, we can now produce, I guess that Australia probably wins the prize 16%. For some of these Shiraz. Yeah. Yeah, you can get up to almost 17%, right? If you have enough fruit and the right yeast. But that's still only 17. And actually, historically, with the yeast we used to have, with beers, you would generally get to about 2, 3%. With fruit wines, maybe slightly more, 4 or 5%. But if you're drinking something like that, you're drinking a 2% beer, and you're working and you're eating, you can drink that all day long and never get dangerously drunk. You're never going to get beyond about maybe 0.08. All of this gets thrown out the window when we figure out distillation and we essentially remove the safety feature from alcohol. And now we can get alcoholic beverages, you know, as strong as we want, up into the 90s BAC. Mm. Distilled liquors just are different. They're still just ethanol, but I think we should really view them as a different drug because they're so much more powerful than the forms of alcohol that we evolved to deal with. They completely overwhelm our physiological defenses. And you can go from, you know, zero to very dangerously drunk in like 10 minutes.
You know, and not only that, but liquor. We often put them with fizzy sweet drinks, which drives the alcohol into the bloodstream much faster again.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So going back to the fact that beer was maybe 2 or 3%, back in the Neolithic age, that meant they had to drink a lot to be getting drunk with each other. I mean, they must have been drinking enormous volumes. Well, these must have been festivals that went for 2 or 3 days by the time they got to anything, like especially if they were eating at the same time. So they probably couldn't have been that drunk. They must have just been a little bit drunk.
Yeah. Yeah, they were, again, probably at about 0.08. If you're drinking constantly a 2% wine or beer, you can get yourself to 0.08, and that's about probably as far as you would get. So they were all kind of pleasantly buzzed. There's some theory that some people argue that the beer they were drinking was also laced with hallucinogens. So that would have given it a little extra kick. But yeah, extreme drunkenness is hard to do in the ancient world.
So that also explains why that was the start of civilization. They were probably coming up with lots of creative ideas at the same time they were all meeting each other. Let's build a stone circle. So the other danger that you talk about is drinking alone. When did people start doing that?
When suburbia was invented.
Oh, really?
Very recently. You know, it's a modern thing. So all traditional societies I know of have tightly controlled alcohol consumption. So you only drink in public. You only drink typically at very carefully controlled rituals. You certainly don't have private access to alcohol in your own home. And even cultures where you actually make the alcohol in your home, So there are cultures like this in South America, for instance, you make chicha at home, have taboos against drinking your own chicha. So you make your own chicha, but you can't drink it. You have to go to your neighbor's house to drink. So these seem to be cultural evolutionary tricks that we've developed to help us with our alcohol consumption. So when we're drinking together, we have all kinds of tricks for controlling the pace of drinking. So in Chinese traditional banquets, you don't drink until someone makes a toast. You don't just sit there drinking as much as you want. Your glass sits there untouched until someone makes a toast, and then you drink. Who can make toasts, how often those happen, is very strictly ritually controlled.
That's exactly the same in Georgia, which is the, you know, said to be the home of Vitis vinifera, that actually mm-hmm. has got that toasting culture as well. Mm-hmm. And what changed that was the Soviets moving in with their spirits culture. It's interesting.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So what we're seeing at the moment is we're seeing a sort of new, what's called neo-prohibitionism. We're seeing the rise of wellness culture and people abandoning alcohol and so on. Do you think that's a permanent condition, or do you think that alcohol has proven itself so useful that it just comes and goes?
I think it's partly a reaction to the new dangers of alcohol. So I think that if we continue drinking 2% beers in social situations, the neo-prohibitionist movement would not have arisen. If you think about prohibition in the States, it was driven by liquor, by the drinking of gin houses in particular. So I think it is a kind of modern, you know, cultures come up with solutions to new problems. And a new problem is the new danger of alcohol. And I think prohibition, neo-prohibitionism is one response to that. So I think it's partly a genuine recognition that alcohol is more dangerous. And we don't consciously think of it this way, but more dangerous than it's been historically. But I also don't think there's any substitute for alcohol that we've invented so far that could serve the functions that it does in the way it does and pair nicely with food and have all the, you know, it's a very carefully honed cultural technology that I still think is indispensable.
Okay, so in the United States, we're starting to see the rise of all sorts of drinks, which I think probably flirt close to the law in terms of functional drinks. And, you know, we're seeing the rise of ayahuasca and all sorts of things. Do you think that they don't have a long evolutionary history with humans? Do you think this is a new exploration, or do you think it's probably going to be a blip and we'll go back to the tried and true?
Some of them do. So ayahuasca, various psychedelic substances, we've been using for as long as we've been using alcohol. They're just very different drugs. They're drugs that you use. Typically, cultures that have psychedelics either use them very rarely if everyone's doing it. So they'll have like an annual ritual or something, biannual ritual. Or there's a specific class of people whose job it is to use them. So shamans, so their job is to do a lot of ayahuasca and tell us what they come back with. Psychedelics de-pattern the brain so powerfully, they're just not useful as social drugs. But maybe, you know, I'm open to the possibility that maybe now that we now know what the active substance is, we can synthesize it, we can carefully dose it. So, you know, microdosing now with psilocybin, maybe that will get us a lot of the benefits of alcohol without the dangers, because psilocybin is another one of these substances that is not harmful physiologically and not physically addictive. So it would be great if we could have a version of alcohol that was based on psilocybin. I just don't see any evidence that that's the case so far.
So one of the interesting things about the debate in health terms about alcohol is that the more it's declared a dangerous substance, the less research can be done on it, because it now becomes unethical to test a substance mm-hmm. that has no safe level on people. In terms of anthropology and history and so on, what still don't we know about alcohol? What are the gaps in our knowledge?
That's a good question. I don't think we understand well how we... how we made this transition to distilled liquors, and to what extent it was driven by human taste. So that could be an evolutionary hijack. Just we like alcohol, and then we like really strong alcohol even more. I suspect it was driven by trade and economics more. So distilling alcohol turns it into a commodity. You know, it's, you can store it for a long time. You can ship it easily to places. So I think one interesting line of examination is that the extent to which distillation allowed alcohol to be commodified in a way that's turned out to be very dangerous for human beings.
Well, actually, when you say that, I'm thinking, so the two great naval nations, Holland and Britain, certainly they took alcohol with them. They took rum and they took gin, or the precursor for gin. So, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So what are you working on now?
I am working on an academic book that I'm almost finished with, on the role of literature in moral education, and particularly in early Confucian moral education. And then I'm going to turn to another trade book, another general audience book, on very roughly hedonism. So,
okay, can you reveal anything that you might be exploring in that book?
It may end up being two books, but right now, so there's two main topics I want to write about for general audience. One is just, at the end of Drunk, I mentioned that in addition to all these evolutionary functions that alcohol has, it also is fun. Like, it makes us feel good. And that can't be part of the story that I tell in Drunk, because I'm telling an evolutionary story. And evolution doesn't care about pleasure. So the fact that it makes us feel good isn't relevant to whether or not evolution will allow it to happen. But we aren't our genes, and we also aren't our cultures. We want to feel good. And so there's a mild defense of hedonism at the end of the book that I want to expand upon, that we should allow pleasure to play a more important role in the way we make decisions.
How much of that do you think is the fact that we're the conscious ape, and that we have to be conscious of the fact that one day we're going to die?
That's part of it, but I think it gets made worse by this kind of hangover from Puritanism, and this, you see it, you know, you talked about these health trends and the kind of wellness and this relentless doing sunrise yoga and then, you know, maximizing your intake, ice baths and all this. It's just. You know, Calvinism all over again, right? It's showing that you're one of the elect through denying yourself pleasure. And I think that is, you know, it created some great things, and very successful things culturally. But I'm more constitutionally a Mediterranean world person, and want a lot of sunshine and wine and good food in my life. So, yeah, so I want to write a defense of hedonism, essentially.
Oh, I love that. When's it coming out? Can you do that before your academic book?
No, I had to do the academic book. So
I think we need your book on hedonism, honestly.
Yeah, it's coming.
You know, we need a defense against the ice baths, quite frankly.
Yeah.
All right. Well, on that note, I absolutely loved the book. I thought it was wonderfully well written, and I look forward to your subsequent books.
Great. Thanks a lot.
You've been listening to Drinks Insider, the podcast that explores the intersection of beverages and commerce. Now, if you would like a summary of this episode, sign up for the Drinks Insider newsletter, which sends you the takeaways. Just go to drinksinsider.com and add your name. And if there's something you think we should be talking about, drop me a line at felicity@drinksinsider.com. And before you go, please don't forget to rate this podcast. 5 stars are most welcome.